Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking up some legal issues today, getting some advice on personal injury claims, learning the ins and outs of criminal law, and a couple of guests for you today. Michael Riley back with us. Mike's a Madison lawyer and a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. Mike, good to see you.
Great to see you again, Larry.
And also with us today, Erica Birma. She practices at the Axley Law Firm as well, focuses on criminal law. And Erica, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
So as you listen to these two experts, what do you want to know about personal injury claims? What other legal questions might you have? I hope you'll join in the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And just a reminder, we intend for today's show to give you some general information, should not consider it as formal legal advice. And we wanted to bring that up as well when we visit with them. Mike, let's start with you for a second here. Personal injury, what are the areas of personal injury that you deal with?
Well, we really deal with a broad spectrum, including products liability cases, firearm injuries. But the focus of almost every personal injury practice is automobile accidents, because that's overwhelmingly the way people get hurt. And so, you know, probably 90% of my work is automobile accidents, whether it involves a claim against your own insurance company because the other driver doesn't have insurance or the other driver doesn't have enough insurance. And we can talk about that, because how much insurance you have can really be critical. You know, if the other person doesn't have it or doesn't have enough, you better have enough, or, you know, you're not going to be compensated fully for your injuries. And, you know, most accidents, frankly, don't involve so much issues of liability. They can. There can be a question about who's at fault and what happened. But, you know, I'll bet way over half of my cases involve people getting hit from behind.
No.
Coincidentally, I got hit from behind by a Spectrum truck on the way to work the other day. So I have direct recent personal experience. But, you know, that's the way people get hurt. And, you know, the thing that I think it's important for people to understand are these, is that when you get in an accident, it's just such an unsettling experience.
Yeah.
And the first thing that people say is, you know, I was just so shaken. And you get an adrenaline rush and your body reacts. And, of course, your mind gets affected by that. And, you know, you're often not thinking really clearly right then. The first thing people normally do is just think, you know, am I okay? Am I bleeding? Is something broken? You know, does everything still seem to work? And that's perfectly understandable and
sure,
appropriate. But you also need, at the time, it's important to think about, you know, if you're hurt, you know, what do you need to do? The other thing that I should say is that it's very common for people not to realize at the time that they're injured. I mean, if you've broken your arm or your leg, or, you know, there's blood gushing from your head,
you know
you're hurt. But for many, many people, there may be some soreness. There may not be much at all, because it's very typical that people's symptoms either don't emerge for 24 to 48 hours, or that they get much worse over 24 to 48 hours. So what we hear all the time is people say, well, you know, gee, I just didn't think that I was injured. And the policeman, you know, if you get in a lawsuit, and in many cases settle without that, but once you get to that stage, insurance companies are always saying, well, did you tell the police you were hurt? Well, people didn't know they were hurt. It's not the biggest thing in the world. It isn't as if you don't tell them that somehow is going to be the death knell for your claim. But it is helpful if you are experiencing symptoms. People are really generally very nice. The notion that everybody immediately grabs their neck and claims they're hurt is just fanciful. Most people, if anything, want to believe they're not hurt. And
yeah,
so, you know, they kind of say, well, I think I'm going to be okay, or I think I'm all right. And if that's the way you feel, that's fine. But it is really important. One, the police should be called. If it's any kind of serious accident, you should get the police there. Normally, it doesn't make a huge difference, but in some cases it can. We have cases where, you know, the other motorist says at the time, yep, my fault, sorry. And then later on, the story changes about what happened. That's not common, but it does happen. So you're always better served to have the police come, and you're better served to explain directly to the officer not just what happened, but also, you know, how you're feeling at that point in time. And, you know, if you're going to go get checked out, people often turn down ambulances, which is fine, because ambulances cost money. And frankly, going to an ER, if you have a significant injury, you should go to the ER. But the truth is, with most soft tissue injuries, sore neck, sore back, you go to the ER, they run a series of x-rays, which are almost always read as normal. And then they say, you know, take two pills and call your doctor in 2 weeks. I mean, they'll tell you to use ice, use this, use that, avoid some activities. And again, if you feel like you have a significant injury, you should go to the ER, absolutely, or to urgent care. But, you know, the big thing is how you're feeling in the next few weeks. And you're going to get calls from the insurance company pretty quickly. And one thing to be wary of early on is companies are big on trying to pressure people to settle early because they settle a lot cheaper if they can get cases settled early. And because people so often believe that they're going to be all right, then what happens is the company calls up and says, well, we'll take care of your medical bills for the next 3 months and we'll give you $1,500. And I've seen people accept those offers and then it turns out they're not all right and they have a longer term problem and suddenly they've settled their claim for far less than what it's worth. Finally, I'll quit for now at least. But finally, it's always worthwhile calling a lawyer before you settle with an insurance company. Lawyers like myself and most people who do the kind of work I do personal injury work, are happy to talk to people. There's no charge for that. Talk to a lawyer. I just was on the phone last night with a woman who was injured and she thinks she's better now. And the company's just making her what's honestly a ridiculous offer. And so we talked and I told her what to do. And I said, go back to him and try this. And if that works, great. And if it doesn't, then give me a call. But it's worthwhile getting some advice. It's not going to cost you anything with the vast majority of lawyers. You can ask in advance and they'll tell you, not going to charge you for this. And then, you know, get the advice before you sign on the dotted line. Because once you sign a release, you're done.
You're done. I mean,
that's it.
Well, Erica, let me turn to you. You specialize in criminal law, and you cover a broad range of things.
I do. I represent people that are accused or being investigated for anything from ordinance violations to misdemeanors to serious felonies, and I also represent people that are accused of crimes in federal court as well.
So that's a pretty broad range. And from the very, I don't know, serious, if it's a federal thing, down to maybe even a misdemeanor kind of thing or
an ordinance, you know, that can be tickets, you know, underage drinking tickets. It can be underage possession. It can be, let's say, ordinance possession of THC. I mean, obviously, depending on the municipality that you're in, affects whether they enforce that type of ordinance or not.
So you've represented from youth to all the way up.
Yes, I have
somebody as old as me.
Or even me, Larry.
27? No, I represent juveniles all the time in their delinquency proceedings, which is where juveniles are accused of crimes and they're staying in the juvenile system. They're not being waived into adult court or trying to be reversed waived back into juvenile court. I've represented individuals all the way through their adulthood. I've had even clients in their 80s.
Oh, well, not that old yet. Let's take some calls. There's callers online. By the way, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kathy in Eagle River, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to first comment on what you had said about people's injuries extending far beyond when they settled. My husband's headaches extended far beyond 10 years after he settled, and he was in a car accident that wasn't his fault. So it affected his work. So had he known, it would have extended, obviously, would have taken a different route. But my question relates, I believe, more to wrongful death. My mother had died in a hospital in Wisconsin. She wasn't treated for her sepsis. It was delayed for a ridiculous amount of time, even after all the tests pointed to septic shock. And, you know, the hospital had an investigation. It took a year. Finally, they said, oh, we could have been, quote unquote, more aggressive in her treatment. But now they've sent it to the insurance company, who's doing another investigation. I feel this is just a delay tactic until our time runs out to file something. So what type of lawyer do I need? What's the best route? The other interesting thing is, one of the doctors, who I believe was one of the most gross offenders and not treating her in a timely fashion for her sepsis, also performed the autopsy and had an interesting result on her death certificate. Does that violate any Wisconsin laws in regard to treating doctor performing an autopsy?
You know, I've never had that question before, and I honestly don't know. I would really question the ethics of doing that,
yeah.
especially when, you know, his treatment may have caused or contributed to the death. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that they would permit that, and especially when you say that he reached an interesting conclusion on her death. That is certainly suspect. I mean, one of the things you can do about that, leaving aside the wrongful death claim, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, what I would consider there is I would go to the state medical the medical examining board, which is under the state of Wisconsin. And you can certainly lodge a complaint about that. And if you file a complaint and just raise that issue, they'll investigate and then they'll make some kind of determination on that. I can tell you that doctors in general don't welcome that at all. You know, they don't want to mm-hmm. be. Nobody does. But, I mean, doctors particularly are really sensitive about that. And so, you know, if you feel that this was that what he did was not proper, and I certainly understand why you would, that's what I do as a starter. And that doesn't address the wrongful death, and we'll talk about that next. But if you look under State of Wisconsin Medical Examining Board, it's at Department of Licensing, they'll have forms online, and you can file a complaint, and I would think they would address that. I would have thought the hospital would, but. The relationship between hospitals and doctors is such that hospitals are not going to second-guess their doctors very often, if at all. You're dealing with an insurance company now. How long ago was this that the death occurred?
It was a year and 3 months ago.
Okay, because my recollection is they've shortened the statute to 2 years on wrongful death, so it was always 3 years. But with statutes of limitations dictate the time period in which you either have to settle or bring a lawsuit. And so it's really important you have that in mind and that I would talk to a lawyer very promptly and make sure that gets dealt with.
Would it be a personal injury lawyer?
Or? It is a personal injury lawyer. I mean, there's you're up in Eagle River. There's statewide firms like Habesch, which is a very fine statewide law firm. I know they have some offices in northern Wisconsin that would certainly be, you know, within reach of you. I know they have one in Rhinelander, I'm sure, and some other places. And I'm sure there are other lawyers. I'm always sensitive. I mean, I'm happy to I have no hesitation recommending the Habesch firm. They're a fine law firm. They send us cases. Occasionally we send them cases. There are a lot of other law firms who do a lot of advertising. You get letters from people, and a lot of them I would not be nearly as high on. So, you know, I think it is important who you talk to. I think it's always a good idea when you're choosing a lawyer to maybe talk to more than one person. You want to make sure you have someone you're comfortable with, because at the end of the day, they're going to be making recommendations to you and telling you what they think you should do. And you need to be confident that those recommendations are well thought out and are appropriate, and that you're willing to say, okay, you know, I'll go along with that. Claims against doctors are difficult. They're expensive. They're hard fought. Companies very seldom settle these voluntarily, so I would not count on the company doing that. They do get settled occasionally. I think that occasions where they get settled without a lawyer are really, really few and far between. So I think I would talk to a lawyer now. I wouldn't wait. The difficulty with claims against doctors are they are always very reluctant to admit responsibility. Always may be a slight exaggeration, but only very slight. I mean, that just they are much more resistant than most folks, including lawyers, although lawyers aren't great about it either. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they just are. They feel it's a blot on their professional reputation. They don't want that, and they tend to fight these claims pretty vigorously. So if the claim it rests on conduct by a hospital employee other than a doctor, nursing staff, those claims, again, are not easy, but they tend to be much easier. The claims against doctors are difficult. The other difficulty is there's a cap on wrongful death. With adults, it's $350,000 for the loss of the person. Now, there are additional elements besides that $350,000 for the fact that someone, you know, you lost someone you loved. You also can make a claim for conscious pain and suffering that happened before the death. So, you know, obviously there was a period of time, and perhaps an extended one, where she was suffering with something that maybe she shouldn't have been suffering with, and that would be part of the claim as well. But the best thing to do is, you know, reach out to a law firm, reach out to somebody who does personal injury. You can go online, and there's no shortage of them. But again, I think the Habesch firm's a good place to start. There are other fine lawyers around who do this work, but make sure it's somebody – you need somebody who does medical malpractice and hospital claims, because they are very specialized. They're not someone that just anyone who handles automobile claims, for instance, can handle. There are a lot of people who think they can do personal injury, some of whom probably shouldn't be, but that's even more true when you get to medical malpractice and hospital.
Yeah. Kathy, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Mike Riley and Erica Birma, lawyers in the Axley Law Firm in Madison, our guests today. Great to have them along. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jane Rotunda, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at personal injury claims and criminal law with our two guests, Mike Riley and Erica Birma, both attorneys in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. We'll take some more calls here. Sally in Madison, let's go to you next. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and thank you to Mike and Erica for coming on the air for this. I have a house in which years ago, like 50 years ago, my father planted a row of arborvitae along one side of the property. And a new neighbor moved in a couple of years ago and told me that his girlfriend thought it would be nice to plant a little garden in an area that turns out to be our property, my property. And so I went to him, this was about 2 weeks after he had moved in, and said, did you have a property, do you know where the property line is? And he shrugged his shoulders. And I said, well, these trees are my trees. And even if they have scruffy dead wood at the bottom, the whole point of arborvitae, for the most part, is privacy. And you've cut them off for about 40 feet up to about 6 feet high above my head, all the way around the trees. And he said, what do you want me to do, glue them back on? And that wasn't too well. I said, well, where do you think the property ends? And he pointed to my garage, which is inset quite a ways. And since this is old property, it turns out his property line is about 6 inches past his driveway, and then the rest is mine, because I paid the hundreds of dollars to have the property surveyed on my side, my lines. And so he has not paid me anything for the installation of a fence. At first I had said I would go along with paying half, but I thought about it and I said I did nothing wrong in this. There's no reason why I should pay half the price of the basically $1,000 on my side for the fence. And he is equally adamant that I told him he could cut them and trim them.
Oh, boy.
Well, I mean, this is a classic thing where you should probably be in small claims. It's up to $10,000. You don't need to hire a lawyer. The problem with these things is by the time you hire a lawyer and pay him, and, you know, sometimes people say it, we're going to do it as a matter of principle. I always encourage people to go read some of the old English cases where they fight over the crook and the trout stream, and both estates ended up bankrupt because, you know, they spent so much on the lawyers. But this one, you could go to small claims court. You can file a simple form yourself. You can go in and tell your story. And I think, you know, his position is not going to be sympathetic. The question is exactly how much is that worth? Well, you know, that's you'd have to ask, and you'd have to have somebody, you know, give you a judgment for a certain amount of money. But, you know, this is his conduct is completely unreasonable. And what I'd probably do, I always encourage people before you do that, I'd go to him one last time and say, look, this is the step I'm going to have to take. If you want to resolve this, let's do it. If you don't, then I'm going to file a small claims action because I think that's the best way for you to try to resolve this.
There you go, Sally. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Suzanne in Whitefish Bay, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Yes, my topic is diminished value. When someone is in an accident and they have a car that has been, for the first time, damaged.
Yep.
Yeah, the topic is my friend is struggling to get diminished value on that vehicle. So the topic isn't familiar to the car dealership. The topic isn't being well received by West Bend. You know, what's their logo? You know, they're just not acknowledging any responsibility. And the car was damaged, and the car was only like 2 months old.
So what do you do in that kind of situation?
Well, you've come to the right place this time, because I actually litigated the case at the courts that established the right to recover diminished value. So what you don't – the key thing to understand is this. Your own company, if you go and your company pays to repair it, they don't have to pay you diminished value because you have a contract with them and that contract does not include diminished value. But the person who caused the damage and their insurance company do have an obligation to pay you diminished value. The real crux of it is, how do you establish diminished value? And I just had a client who actually went to somebody who did an evaluation and actually gave us an opinion on diminished value. And I don't have it in front of me. If you want to call our office at some point, I'll be happy to give you the name of that company. The dealership should be familiar with that. I mean, the dealership knows darn well that if they get a car that has damage, it always shows up on Carfax or something like that now. And somebody who comes in just isn't going to pay the same amount of money. Now, if you're talking about a scuff in the bumper that they buffed out, that's a different thing. But if there's significant damage to the car, and it, particularly in a car that's this new, it does diminish the value. There's no question about that. And then it just becomes a matter of how much. They are legally responsible for the diminished value. It's establishing what that is. That's kind of the devil in the details. And again, I always go, the dealership should be able to help you with that. But if for some reason they can't, you can just go online, look at our website. Our website is axley.com. And, you know, you can get my name, contact me, and I'll get you the contact information for this service that he used to establish the loss of value.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Erica, I want to go back to you for a bit here. There are, as I was hearing Mike talk about trying to work things out and so forth, it brought to mind to me plea bargain. I don't know why, but you do some work in that area, do you not?
I do tons of work in that area, as it turns out. Plea bargaining is kind of obviously a hot topic right now with everything that's been going on nationally right now, when we've been talking about, you know, Jeffrey Epstein's prior conviction in Florida. What a lot of people don't realize about plea bargaining is, so you have a charge issued, and the state has to decide whether or not they can prove that charge beyond a reasonable doubt. And as a case progresses, sometimes witnesses become uncooperative, unavailable. Like, the strength of their case changes as the case evolves. Or if you have a defense investigator and you learn something about the witnesses that would affect their credibility or that affects their ability to perceive what was happening, it's a risk for both parties to go to trial, because it's all or nothing. I mean, you have what are called lesser included offenses. So what I'll say is compromise verdicts. But generally speaking, you know, if they're proceeding on the one charge, you know, the state runs the risk, or the United States government runs the risk of losing. So plea bargains are a way for both parties to be what I would describe as equally unhappy.
And you wind up doing a lot of that.
Well, I mean, in reality, I would say that trial rates in the criminal realm are probably higher than in the civil realm.
Certainly.
But you still have that risk, because some places and certain circuits, some federal districts, you have this thing called a trial tax. And what that is if you go to trial and make the state prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, if you're convicted, it's entirely possible that the sentence may go up because you exercised your constitutional rights.
Oh.
Yes. So by plea bargaining, you may have some certainty that you wouldn't have in a trial. Because in a trial, your life is in the hands of 12 plus 2. And what I mean by that is the 12 jurors plus 2 alternates, potentially. Whereas with a plea bargain, you know what the offer is. You know what the recommendations are going to be. Granted, the judge could still reject it and say, I'm not going to follow those recommendations. But at least you have a framework with what you're working with in terms of resolution of the case.
How often does the judge reject a plea bargain? I would think not terribly often.
It depends on the judge.
But so that's sort of the part of the process. Yes. Is you know some judges may or may not go along.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's part of the advice that you give the client is, okay, this judge has this tendency to reject joint recommendations. So you have to be prepared for that.
If the judge does reject it, says, I'm not going to accept that, can you withdraw the plea, or is the plea kind of contingent on the judge saying, okay, I'll go along with what you guys have agreed on?
Unfortunately, no, you can't withdraw your plea because during the plea colloquy, the judge says you understand that the statutory maximum is 90 days, 12 years, whatever it is, and you understand that I understand that the parties are making this joint recommendation, but you understand that by making this plea that I could sentence you up to and including the maximum penalty. So as a part of the plea colloquy, they're already put on notice that the judge could reject that joint recommendation.
You know, I know there have been, you know, calls by some people to do away with plea bargaining because they say it, you know, it forces people to accept, you know, that they're guilty of things they don't really think they're guilty of. But I guess based on my limited experience from long ago, if you took away plea bargaining, our criminal justice system would implode.
The system couldn't handle that level of trial because, I mean, trials can take anywhere from a half day to weeks to months. It depends on what the charge is. It depends on if there's multiple defendants. The criminal justice system could not support.
One of the things I've noticed, or it seems like anyway, that trials here in Wisconsin compared to other states like California tend to go faster.
Oh, absolutely. I would say that our trial, one, the length of time from charge to trial is significantly faster, but the trials also move faster than, like you said, in California. And I don't know if that's just because of their process or if it's just that those of us in Wisconsin are more efficient or we know what the judges expect of us. Because when the judges set the trial, they ask for an estimate of time. So they know when they're looking for blocks of time. Are they looking for 3 days? Are they looking for 5 days? Are they looking for a month? What are they looking for? Not to say that if it runs over, they're not going to cut you off and say, okay, you're done.
Right.
But they look for specific blocks of time.
Now, the federal court in Madison, it's Western District of Wisconsin, has been known for some time as the rocket docket because they really move cases along. I mean, you don't have years elapse from the time you file a case until the time it gets heard. I mean, they push discovery in civil cases, and they push the process. And frankly, they tend to streamline trials as well. Do they do the same thing in criminal?
Well, absolutely. You have the statutory obligations in federal court. In the Western District of Wisconsin honors those statutory demands, whereas, let's say, a district like the Southern District of New York or the Eastern District of New York or even the Northern District of Illinois, Chicago Division, because of the volume of cases that are indicted in any specific year, they can't maintain that statutory schedule because they just don't have the resources to be able to do that.
Interesting. Well, we have more callers. I want to give Rick and Oconomowoc a chance to join in. Rick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Fascinating program. I really want to congratulate your experts there. A friend of mine in Milwaukee has a problem. He has a court-appointed attorney handling his case, but for some reason, for the last 3 months, he's not been able to have any contact with that attorney, and he's just wondering what to do. Does he go to the state bar? How does he get this man to respond?
Well, unfortunately, Rick, that's kind of part and parcel of the quandary with public defenders. And why I say that is because public defenders, especially in a populated county like Milwaukee County, can probably have over 400 or 500 active cases. And I'm not saying that your friend's case is not important to that public defender, but unfortunately, public defenders kind of operate by where's the biggest fire and what do I need to do now? So, you know, until your friend's case is coming up on a hearing, he may not hear from that public defender. I mean, he can email, he can call. I would say, generally speaking, public defenders are more responsive to emails because they're not in the office, because they're either in court all day, they could be in the jail all day. I'm not justifying not returning a call or an email or anything like that, but just knowing that when you're in a populated county, they have so many cases, they're so understaffed, and they really don't have the ability to pay as much attention to each individual defendant and each individual case as, let's say, a private attorney could.
So in Rick's friend's case, I mean, he's asking for a public defender, so he's probably, it's a financial thing for him, but could he say, okay, I'm going to quit the public defender and hire a lawyer?
He absolutely always has that right to do that. He has a constitutional right to counsel if he's unable to afford it. But if he feels like he's not being best served by that public defender, he could absolutely hire private counsel at any point in time, discharge the public defender, and move forward with private counsel.
Yeah, just a couple quick comments. One, and I know Eric would echo this, the public defenders are disgracefully underfunded. It's a disaster. And it in a way, Erica says, you have a constitutional right to counsel. It's really difficult to square what the state and the federal government does in terms of funding public defender's office with honoring that right in a meaningful way.
But the other problem that we have, and this is a local problem, not necessarily a national problem, is so when there's a conflict within the public defender's office, they appoint out lawyers that are in the private bar to represent individuals. And in Wisconsin, that rate hasn't changed since 1986.
Yeah, nobody could make, I mean, if you could live in your mother's basement and not make a living doing public defender's work, you know, if you're taking those cases. The public defenders I've known here, honestly, have been very capable, very decent people. But as Erica says, what would a reasonable, maybe 50 or 60 files would be a lot in terms of a caseload? And Erica's saying 400. So you can see the problem. I mean, I would at least try, I'd talk to the head of the office. It's probably the thing I do is just say, look, you know, I really need to talk to this person. I really need them to communicate. That might get something done. It might not, but that's probably, you know, the best approach. I don't know that filing a complaint with the bar is really going to be all that helpful. I mean, you have a right to do that. It's really OLR, not the bar. It's the Office of Lawyer Regulation with the Supreme Court, where if you have a problem with a lawyer's conduct, that's where you file your complaint. But I doubt that that's really going to provide much benefit.
No, I agree with you. But the only other thing that I would say, Mike, is not necessarily going to the head of the office. There's usually like a senior litigator in public defender offices. Mm. And they kind of help mentor the younger lawyers. So they might be able to be kind of the interim step before you go to the head of the office, because the head of the office has all the administrative responsibilities in addition to their caseload.
Good. There you go, Rick. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Jim in Madison next. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thank you for being there. I have my wife suffered a fall at a local convenience store. They were stocking, and there was one of their crates or cartons in the aisle. And she tripped on it and had multiple contusions, are quite likely a concussion, and a crushed vertebrae. And we did speak with a lawyer, and so that her medical bills will be paid for once she gets done with it. My question is, where and if does pain and suffering ever enter into that kind of a situation?
No, in terms of damages, when you're injured and it was caused by somebody else's lack of care, you're entitled to recover, you know, all your medical expenses, any out-of-pocket expenses. Those are called special damages. The general damages are the pain, suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life. And as you know all too well, you've watched your wife go through this, there's a lot of that with many of these injuries. And you're certainly entitled to recover that. That obviously is less easy to establish at what constitutes a fair amount of compensation. But yeah, you're certainly entitled to that. In these situations, slip and fall cases are run the gamut. They are not easy cases. They are not like getting hit from behind at a red light. But they are cases that companies will pay money on. I'm assuming, is your lawyer helping you with this now?
She did speak with a lawyer, and the result was that he didn't. My impression, I'd have to speak directly with her, which is that that side of it was not an option.
I don't know what the conversation was, but if that's what was said, that's not true. Now, what the lawyer may have been saying is, I think they're not going to agree that they're liable, and that's the difference. Many businesses, probably most, have medical payments coverage, and that coverage doesn't depend on anybody being at fault. So if you are injured on their premises, they'll pay up to a certain amount of money for medical bills. It's usually not an open-ended amount. It's usually a specified amount of $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it might be. But that doesn't require that you show anyone is at fault. In order to recover for pain, suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life, that's what we call a liability claim. And liability means that they didn't exercise due care, and because they didn't, she was injured. So, maybe she needs to talk to another lawyer. Everybody takes a little different position on these. Some of it depends on the severity of the injury and whether it's a permanent injury. But again, legally, she certainly is entitled to recover those damages if you can establish they were negligent.
And there you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Taking a look at personal injury claims and criminal law with our two guests today, Michael Riley and Erica Bierma, both attorneys with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Join in. Questions at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at personal injury claims, criminal law today with our two guests, Mike Riley and Erica Bierma, attorneys in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have them along. Mike, I wanted to go back to an earlier caller who was talking about the diminished value on a vehicle and wondering about the statute of limitations. I don't think we covered that part.
I didn't, and it's a great question, not just for that call, but for a lot of calls. I mean, one, the statute of limitations are statutes that every state has that say you have a certain amount of time to bring a claim, and it covers all sorts of different things. It covers criminal matters as well. And in the civil reign, if you need to either settle a claim or file a lawsuit, once you file a lawsuit, that stops the statute from running. But you have to, the statutes say if you don't do that within the time set in the statutes, you lose your right to bring a claim. So the diminished value claim is almost certainly 6 years. Most property damage claims are 6 years. So, vehicle damage itself, the diminished value. Contract claims generally are usually 6 years. There are exceptions to all of this. And, if you have a question, you should go to a lawyer and make sure that you get the correct information. But I think in this case, it's 6 years. Personal injury claims are 3 years, generally speaking. So if you're injured, you want to bring a claim, got to do that within 3 years. The wrongful death thing we talked about before was 2, and they just changed that fairly recently. And that's a concern because they change things, and people may have heard from a neighbor or a friend or maybe even a lawyer at some point that they had a certain amount of time. And in recent years, our legislature has been very active about undermining rights to bring claims and undermining victims' rights. And so it's always well to check very early in the process. There's almost nothing. I think there might be a handful of things that are 1 year. There are a fair number that are 2 years, including intentional torts if somebody does something deliberately to harm you. But again, the best thing to do is if you have a claim, talk to a lawyer and make sure you know what the statute is that governs that claim.
Let's take another call. Maddie and DePere will go to you next. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I have a question and also a comment. What is the statute of limitations on federal? That's a question. But also a comment that it's easy to get a lawyer to defend in the case of an accident. But if it's gross negligence on the part of a doctor, it's almost impossible to get a lawyer, including Habish, Habish, and Rotier.
No, it is difficult to get a lawyer to take those cases, and that, you know, is certainly not unique to the Habesh firm. Any firm that does that work is reluctant to take the cases unless you have a very strong case for liability. One of the problems is the cases are very expensive to pursue. You have to go out and hire experts who have to be doctors. They are expensive. So you're going to spend, if you try a medical malpractice case, a law firm can easily expend $80,000 to $100,000 or even more than that, perhaps significantly more. And those are costs that the firm absorbs. So, I mean, that's if they don't win, they don't get that money back in virtually any case. These cases, and believe me, it's deeply frustrating to lawyers. And I know one of the lead lawyers at Habesh, a very fine lawyer, tried a series of these cases and didn't prevail in several of them, despite the fact that he's a good lawyer, that they screen cases carefully, and anyone who does that work screens their cases. With all of that, when these cases go to trial, the defense wins about 8 out of 10. Mm. And the reality is the defense can get a cajillion doctors to get up on the stand in almost any case and say, oh, that just happens. That's one of those things. That's really not negligence. I once, years ago, had a doctor, they had operated, they were supposed to be doing a biopsy on a rib. They did the wrong side, the rib on the other side. And the doctor said, well, at least we established that there was no cancer out there, which begged the question why you didn't just take a piece out of every bone in the person's body. And, you know, I'm being facetious, but there's nothing funny about the fact that doctors' ability to justify whatever happened is legendary. And it would be nice to say everybody gets up and is straightforward with these things. I think that they honestly believe that. But the fact is that they have this concept of, you know, what's within the ordinary risk. Well, that's just an expected risk. Well, my argument is that, negligence is an expected risk. Certain percentage of the time, you know, people are not going to do the thing right. That doesn't mean it's not negligent. I mean, the guy that hit me the other day, I'm sure he told me he's been driving for Spectrum for years. He said, I've never had an accident. And I'm sure that's true. But that doesn't mean he's not at fault for this one. You know? So, and he wasn't saying that. He was a really nice guy, actually. But, you know, the point is that's why it's difficult to take these cases, because they're so difficult to win. They don't settle. Our cases almost all settle. I mean, we have to go into suit quite often, but way before trial, our cases settle almost uniformly. One case out of maybe 300 to 400 in the normal personal injury field goes to trial. In medical malpractice, it's probably, you know, of the ones they take, it's probably 1 out of 2 or you know, maybe more than that. I mean, it's a very high percentage. They just don't settle very often. So, you know, it's always worthwhile. If one firm turns you down, there are other firms who do that work, and it's certainly worth talking to them. But by the time you've heard it from a couple firms, unfortunately, it reflects the reality in that area of the law. And I know it's frustrating to people, and believe me, it's frustrating to lawyers, including the folks at Habesh.
Maddie, thank you so much for your call. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn now. Hi, Nick.
Hey, my wife was pregnant about 20 years ago, well, 20 years ago now. And she would just normal run to Walmart, and they had just mopped the floors. We didn't know it. She didn't know it. I wasn't with her. And there's an off-duty paramedic there, and she slipped on the floor. And 2 days later, she had a miscarriage, and we went to sue Walmart, and no lawyer would take the case. And we talked to the lady at Walmart, and she's like, take the $1,500 because we're big enough. We'll just keep delaying it, and you just go run out of money. There's no way you can sue us. So I was a little frustrated with that. But
oh, well.
Well, again, we talked a little bit about slip and falls. They're difficult cases. They're not like, you know, traffic accidents where more often than not the fault is really clear. And, you know, here it sounds like they were mopping the floor. They created a condition which certainly could, you know, make them liable because they created the condition. There are two situations. One is where they create a condition that creates an unnecessary risk. The other one is where there's something, you know, somebody else at the store spills something and they don't clean it up promptly. And the first one's usually easier than the second one. But again, a lot of lawyers will shy away from trip and falls. I remember talking to a judge back maybe 10 years ago, and he said, you know, the last 8 of these I tried, the defense won. And so, again, Personal injury lawyers work on a contingency fee basis. We're not getting paid by the hour. We get paid a portion of what we settle or win for these people. And so it does, I mean, when you look at taking a case, some of that has to be, you know, a rational analysis of what you're going to do economically with the case. I mean, can you make this work so that you're doing something positive for the client and you're still making a living? And there are a lot of times with slip and falls, lawyers just don't think they can make that march. I'm terribly sorry you had that experience. It's awful to have that happen.
Nick, thank you for calling. Jane in Dowsman will go to you next. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, my son is in his 20s, and he lives in an apartment in Oconomowoc, and a neighbor of his got mad at him and hit him from behind on his head, and then when Jacob turned around, the guy smacked him and hit him in the face. Jacob ended up going to the hospital, needed stitches, and the police came, and the policeman said to Jacob, "All right, if you don't let it go, then I'm going to give you both tickets, and you're both going to get tickets for battery." And that's that. And now here Jacob is with his face with stitches. And I don't understand how a cop could do that. And where does Jacob go from here?
So, Erica Bierma, what do you think?
Erica's life is cops.
My life is all law enforcement. So I'm sorry to hear about your son. And I'm not saying that I believe that what police always do is correct or right. But unfortunately, when they're dealing with, let's say, a fight in this particular situation, they try to sort out what's going on as quickly as they can to try to diffuse the situation. And what I don't know, and I'm not blaming your son, but what I don't know is, what did your son say about what happened? And what I mean by that is, so let's say the neighbor punched him in the face, but did your son say something first that provoked the fight? I mean, the police just, I mean, it's not a perfect system. It's not a perfect answer, but they try to figure out what's going on. Their responsibility is to figure out who the quote unquote primary aggressor is or was, and they try to sort it out from there. I mean, what I would say is, if he was completely the victim in the crime, I mean, then he should hire a lawyer and fight the ticket.
Yeah, he should do that. Thank you, Jane. Good luck. Christina in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Well, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, this summer, I was actually living in Wisconsin, and I was driving down a county highway, and a 13-year-old boy in a four-wheeler couldn't stop at the end of his driveway, and he pulled out into our lane to turn around. So I had to swerve to the right not to hit him head-on. I went over a ravine into a creek bed. My car was totaled, which was covered by my insurance, but my daughters and I also have medical bills. And we contacted their homeowner's insurance, and they said because the boy was on the road and not on his property, they weren't liable for our medical expenses. So I'm just wondering if this is true. Do I go after the homeowner themselves, or do you just recommend seeking out an attorney?
No, I'd probably talk to an attorney, because an attorney can take a look at the insurance policy. In my experience, adjusters frequently have no idea what their policy actually covers. I mean, they have their little notions of what it is, but I listen to them all the time talk to me about what they think is covered or not, and I say, look at this part of your policy, look at this. I'll send them a case and say, here's what the case law actually says. And, you know, I'd have to look at it, but, you know, that's the best thing to do is get an attorney, have the attorney look at the policy to see what it does or doesn't cover. Because it's a four-wheeler, it's probably not covered under the auto policy. Auto policies almost always exclude vehicles not designed for use on public roads. And that raises its own set of questions, because you see a lot of these vehicles being driven on public roads. Sometimes it's not licensed for operation on public roads. The homeowner's policy usually is where the coverage would be, but that's, you know, what if he were driving down the interstate on this thing, or driving down the highway on it, and this happened, and they have an exclusion that says that, then it probably wouldn't be covered. But the fact that he simply came out of his driveway to turn around is not necessarily going to get to that exclusion. And my sense would be the exclusion probably wouldn't bar coverage for that. So, again, I think, you know, you feel free if you want to, you know, go on our website, reach out to me. That's fine. If you want to contact another attorney, that's fine.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's see. Dennis in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. I have, I don't know if you folks handle these questions, but this is a small claims court question. And I'm wondering, it's something I bought on the internet. In fact, it happened twice. It came from someone else, and I use it here in Wisconsin. It's defective, and they won't back anything up. Duke, will the small claims thing occur here in Winnebago County? And do I sue the person with whom I'm dealing or the company?
I'm not sure. You bought this from an individual, not from the company?
No, I bought it from a company on the internet.
Bought it from the company on the internet. The test is whether they're doing business in the state, and likely they are. If you bring the small claims action, they're going to have to respond. They're going to have to get a lawyer. That's often enough to get them to just say, this is not worth it. Let's just take care of this. I mean, if we're not talking about a very large item. So I'd file the small claims action. They will serve them by mail, and then they'll have to respond.
There you go. Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it. Visiting today with Michael Riley and Erica Bierma. Mike's and Erica, as a matter of fact, are both with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. They'll be with us up until about 23 minutes or so after 12, and we'll be talking with them about more. So stay listening in. We're going to take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Michael and Erica. You stay with us. I'm Larry Miller. We're taking a look at legal issues today here on the show. Larry Miller here on Mike Riley and our second guest, Erica Bierma, with us. They both practice at the Axley Law Firm in Madison, and great to have them with us. You may have some questions about personal injury claims or other legal questions. I hope you'll join in the conversation as we move along today. Mike Riley, I know that we were talking with a woman before our news break whose young son was assaulted, and I think you wanted to add something to that conversation.
Yeah, Erica addressed the interaction with the police, and unfortunately, I see plenty of that as well. There's some great police officers out there, and like every other profession in the world, there are some that just do the very minimum to get by. And, you know, it sounds like, unfortunately, he drew one of those. And the other thing that's hard is that, you know, those situations are often, she knows what her son said, and what her son said may be the absolute truth. The officer's not there when it happens. He may well have a guy on the other side who's saying, he jumped me and I had to do this. Now, it's a little hard to explain how you hit him in the back of the head and cut the back of his head, frankly. But I guess the point from my standpoint is you certainly have a civil claim. It's a personal, you know, it's an intentional tort. The problem is it probably won't be covered by insurance because insurance almost always excludes intentional torts. But, you know, you certainly could sue the guy personally. You could do that in small claims court for up to $10,000. You know, if you wanted to go and talk to a lawyer and see if there's something more than that, you certainly could do it. The problem with a lot of lawyers is lawyers, again, get paid on a percentage basis. Yeah. And where there's no insurance involved, insurance is almost always the source of recovery. Going after people individually is generally a lot more difficult. So it's another one of those where you might want to think about a small claims case.
Gina in Wausau, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gina. Gina, are you there? Did we lose Gina? She wondered about how to find a lawyer for federal cases. Do you want to take a crack at that, Erica?
I would love to. So for, I would say, federal criminal cases, there are very few of us that have handled federal criminal cases. So when you're looking for a criminal defense attorney, you can't just rely on the state court practitioner because, unfortunately, the procedures are completely different. The penalties are completely different. There are these lovely things, you can't see my air quotes over here, called sentencing guidelines. Like, it's completely different than the state system. So you can't rely on the fact of a state practitioner saying, yes, I can help you with this. So you can Google I mean, that's always helpful to try to find federal attorneys. I mean, I'm happy to, if she wants to reach out to me to mm-hmm. give her some names of those of us who regularly practice in federal court, because it's a very, very, very small district and there are very few of us that regularly practice there.
You know, the other thing is, in Erica's practice, everybody's practice, we deal with adjusters, we deal with attorneys on a regular basis, and having those relationships is really important. Mm. I think, if anything, it's even more important in Erica's case. And again, those the people who are prosecuting federal cases are not the people who prosecute state cases.
No. And also, I mean, having someone that has that professional relationship with the prosecutors, with U.S. probation, with the judges, with pretrial services, I mean, that's always to the benefit of the potential client.
Is it often mentioned in, let's say you go online to a law firm and you say, okay, here's so-and-so, would it say that they practice in federal or not?
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it'll just say, let's say, computer crimes, drug crimes. Sometimes that can be all-encompassing, and some firms don't delineate between state court criminal defense and federal defense, but they need to ask that question, and they need to ask the question about what is their familiarity with the respective district that they're in. You know, are they familiar with the Western District? Are they familiar with the Eastern District? That kind of thing. I mean, you have to ask a lot more questions when you're looking for a criminal defense attorney in the federal realm versus at the state realm, just because the penalties are so severe in the federal system.
Well, and when it comes to civil actions, my bailiwick, personal injury matters, it's also, I don't think it's quite as dramatically different, but it is a very different system with different their own rules. It's and having somebody with experience in federal court really is important. And so when you talk to a lawyer, I think it's important not to simply ask, do you handle federal cases, but to ask, how many have you handled? Is it a significant part of your practice? You know, how many cases have you handled in the Western District of Wisconsin or whatever? Because you really do need somebody with not just a notion that they can do it, but who can tell you about how much they have done it and what their experience is.
Let's go to Linda in Viroqua next. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have just a general question about liability waivers. My kids over the years have been involved in sports, and I've been doing things that too that need a waiver. I'm fine with signing a waiver, and because, you know, you don't want to have frivolous, unwarranted lawsuits against companies or businesses. But a lot of these waivers also have a clause in there that talks about if they are negligent, you also won't sue them. And I have a problem with that component of it. In the past, when my kids were involved in sports, I would cross out that part because I thought if they had been negligent, I'm not going to agree to not sue them or get some resolve to that. But now a lot of these things are online. You can't pick and choose what you sign and cross out. So is that kosher that they can say you and I sign away my rights even if they are negligent or, you know, their equipment's not maintained or they're not diligent about their facilities, that I can't sue them if they've done me wrong?
In a word, no. Wisconsin has addressed this, and again, happens to be something near and dear to my heart because I've argued this at the Supreme Court more than once. And what the law is in Wisconsin is pretty simple. Wisconsin has said that these blanket waivers that say basically no matter what they do, they're not responsible, are not binding. The only cases in which Wisconsin has been willing to enforce these waivers are cases where somebody has volunteered, in one case, to flag at a road race at Road America. Things like that. If you know, there are a handful of situations where you decide you want to participate in a very high risk activity and you say, okay, I'm going to sign. There's other cases where people have crashed race cars and they said that the fire crew didn't do a good job. Those cases, they'll enforce it. Going to the gym, going to your kid's swim class, participating in your soccer program, in those cases, and for that matter, generally speaking, ski areas, those releases generally won't work. The waivers will not be binding. And just real quickly, they're not liable anyway unless they're negligent. I know you talked about frivolous lawsuits, and believe me, that's a myth in large part. I mean, people don't bring frivolous lawsuits for the simple reason that lawyers don't get paid. Nobody pays frivolous claims. There might have been a day 50 years ago, but those days are long gone. And no company is going to pay a claim they regard as frivolous, and no sensible lawyer is going to take one because he's not going to make a penny on the whole thing. But the bottom line here is they're not responsible just because you're injured in their gym. I mean, if you fail to, you know, you don't see the machine and you trip over it, you're not going to have a claim. If they're negligent, you have a claim, and the waiver almost certainly will not be effective.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeremy in West Bend has something for us. Hi, Jeremy.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you for taking my call as well. Mine is also liability related. I spent about 9 years working for one of those uniform delivery services, you know, and we bring in the floor mats and all that jazz as well. And sometimes those mats are not exactly as flat as a person would like them to be, but what are you going to do? We have to go on with our day. I always wondered if a customer at a gas station or something like that tripped and fell on one of those mats, where exactly does that, you know, waterfall of liability, you know, how does that flow at that point? Because it's on private property, but it's, you know, there's somebody that came and put that there, and you see what I'm getting at. So I always wondered how that actually falls down legally.
No pun intended, right? Here's how that plays out. One, I always think of those things, you know, people put them down in theory because they're going to make it safer. I think they generally make it more hazardous because they always wrinkle. You know, I don't think I've ever seen one that didn't wrinkle. The question is this: if there's nothing wrong with the mat, if the mat is, you know, if it's properly attended to, it's going to lie flat and do its job and absorb the water, and which, you know, is understandable why people want that done. Then probably the company that delivered the mat has no responsibility. The company that places the mat there has a responsibility to be diligent in ensuring that the mat doesn't become a problem. We talked a little earlier about trip and falls. They're not easy cases in any situation. And with those mats, you not only would have to show that you know, the mat wasn't proper and that you tripped on it and it caused you an injury, you'd have to show that the people who had put the mat down, the people at the facility, had knowledge of the fact that it was bunched up and could create a trip hazard, and the opportunity to correct that. So somebody came to them half an hour before and said, say those mats at the door are really a problem. Absent that, it's going to be awful tough for anybody to bring a successful lawsuit on those.
There we go, Jeremy. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it. Kathy in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
My husband is a quadriplegic as a result of a bicycle accident.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And we pursued a lawsuit against the caregivers, the intermediary caregivers in Madison. One of the people in charge got on top of him and tried to get him to breathe better. As a result, from my knowledge, he caused a break between his medication and his stomach. Consequently, he was 4 weeks without any medication, and his weight dropped precipitously. As you have already mentioned, we pursued a lawsuit, but it ended with a description by the lawyer that it was too much money to pursue. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, I can. It's just endlessly distressing, and I can't tell you how badly I feel that you have to deal with this, that obviously you had to deal with the quadriplegia to begin with, and I've had this happen. I've had clients who were severely disabled as a result of an accident, and then, you know, somebody doesn't do the right thing in terms of the treatment, and that just adds, you know, to the misery of the whole situation. You know, again, the problem is that often getting experts proving these cases is extremely expensive. Normally speaking, to me, I mean, if this is something where it's probably not a doctor problem, it's more likely a nursing problem. I don't know the facts, obviously. But in my experience, those cases are a bit easier. They're not easy at all, but they are less daunting to pursue. You know, if you had, if, assuming you're still within the statute of limitations, which is probably 3 years, I mean, you could talk to another lawyer and see if they have a different view of it. It's like anything else. All lawyers don't view these cases as the same, in the same way. And there might be somebody else that would be willing to take another look. They are hard-fought, very expensive, and for a lawyer, it's just financially really difficult to look at these and decide whether they think they can do something positive for you and still make a living. And I don't like any of that. I don't think most lawyers do, but that's the reality of what we do.
Kathy, I'm sorry as well. I thank you for your call and appreciate it very much. Thank you. Joe in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have a situation where in 1999, I established a website called www.stemgroup.com for a consulting company that I wanted to form when I retired. About 10 years later, the company that had the URL told me that they took it away because I didn't pay the bill. They said I didn't have information to contact them, which I did, and I can show all this. At any rate, the short of it is I've never been able to get the website back, and today it sells for $25,000 and has never been sold to anybody as far as I know, and I'd still like it back. So do I have any legal consideration, recourse on this with that company in the past?
Well, the difficulty is if we're talking about 1999, you've got a problem with statute of limitations. It's likely a contract claim, and that would have run in 6 years. And there are exceptions to the statute of limitations. There's a discovery rule where if you had no reason to know that this had happened, that happens sometimes with medical cases. But I don't see that as likely applying here. So the simple answer is, given the amount of time that's elapsed, I doubt you're going to be able to do anything.
There you go, Joe. Thank you. Tim in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Great show. The reason I'm calling is I had a sore throat about 3 years ago, went to my primary doctor in the UW system. They diagnosed it as a sore throat and prescribed medication for a sore throat. It was still sore 2 or 3 weeks later. I called the nurse. She asked if I wanted to see the doctor again or if I wanted to see an ear, nose, and throat person, which I elected to do. I went to them. They put the tongue depressor in my mouth and said, "You have cancer."
Oh, boy. Because we're getting a little tight on time, there's a misdiagnosis. And in 30 seconds, can you provide us a little information?
Very quickly. Misdiagnosis cases have two elements. First is the misdiagnosis. The second one that's the problem here is you have to show that if it had been diagnosed correctly right away, it would have made a difference. Given the amount of time you're talking about, I doubt you'd ever get an opinion that said that the outcome would have been different if the family doc had diagnosed this appropriately right away.
Well, on that note, Mike and Eric, I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to do this again.
We'd love to, Larry. Thanks.
We'd love to, and I appreciate it.
Mike Riley and Erica Bierma from the Axley Law Firm of Madison. You know, we're lucky in this state because we have a lot going on. So much so, we've started a monthly segment that features some great places and events to explore throughout Wisconsin. Something pretty cool coming up next for you to check out.
We have lots of events in our state, but rarely, if ever, do they include music, art, and sustainability. Well, we found one that does, and it's happening at the end of September in Rhinelander. We have Melinda Childs on the line with us. She is part of Art Start in Rhinelander, and she's going to tell us all about it. Hi, Melinda. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having us. We're excited to share about Project North.
Well, it sounds pretty exciting. So, as you just said, your event is called Project North. And where did the idea of pairing a music and art festival with sustainability come from?
Well, the original idea for the festival in general was kind of inspired by South by Southwest.
down in Texas.
Sure.
And so that, of course, is art and music and technology. And we just went a different way with it. We had another member of our committee, our early planning committee, that was very passionate about sustainability. And, of course, living up here in the North Woods, that's one of our greatest assets is our environment. We really wanted the festival to be something that showed off not just the arts and culture that we have up here, but also our environmental attributes.
And this is your first year, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, how exciting is that?
Yeah.
why don't you talk about where and when it's going to take place so people can write it down?
Sure. The festival, primarily the music and sustainability components, will take place downtown Rhinelander. We have three different venues. And then additionally, another huge component of the art aspect is outside of downtown at the Treehaven campus. That's part of the College of Natural Resources for University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. And then one other element is one of our kickoff events is the Northern National Art Competition, which will be at the Nicolay College Gallery. So we have a lot of community partners, and we're really trying to get the festival all over the community of Rhinelander.
And what were the dates again?
It is the last weekend of September, with the kickoff event starting on Thursday the 26th, and then the music and art all day the 27th and 28th.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the music. What are some of the performers that you've got booked?
We have a very diverse lineup. There's not any specific genre represented. It's all from bluegrass to funk to metal, just a whole bunch of different bands.
So let's talk about the sustainability element of this festival. Tell us about that.
We have a lot of different things going on that reference sustainability. One of our main events will be an Eco Village, which will give participants an opportunity to visit educational booths, purchase sustainable goods, and hear expert presenters on the Eco Village stage. We're also tying it in with our food and beer, which is also another big component, of course, of any festival.
Of course.
We're going to feature a large selection of tap beer and Oktoberfest beers, but we're going to be using refillable souvenir cups. So refill, don't landfill, is a big part of our philosophy.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Melinda Childs is the Development Director of ArtStart in Rhinelander. She's talking to us about Project North, which is happening September 26th through the 28th. Hope you can go. Thank you so much, Melinda.
Thank you very much.
Project North is at the end of September, but we have a couple of other events that you may want to check out before that. Labor Day weekend in Sheboygan has become home to the annual gathering of surfers from all over the world. After all, it is the beginning of the Midwest surfing season. Who knew? The following weekend, on Saturday, September 7, Manitowoc will celebrate Sputnik Fest, the annual celebration that commemorates the day in 1962 when a 20-pound piece of Russian Sputnik 4 landed on a street corner there. Also on the 7th, you can attend the Partyville Watermelon Festival. The town is home to the U.S. Watermelon Speed Eating and Seed Spitting Championships, and that's been going on for over 50 years. That is just a very few of the many events taking place around the state in the next few weeks. If you have an event you'd like to tell us about, email timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org and find links to the events we talked about today at wpr.org/timeout. I'm Jill Nadeau. Until next month, get out and explore, dream, and discover.
Does sound like a lot of fun, doesn't it? And by way of full disclosure, we should mention Project North is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many sponsors. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll talk with a turfgrass expert, Paul Koch. In the meantime, hey, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.